thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 36 for the 16th of January 2009. Tweeting into 2009. I'm Dan Cohen. And welcome to our listeners, new and old, to the first Digital Campus podcast of 2009, broadcasting live from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. Welcome to everyone, and welcome, of course, to my co-hosts and co-panelists on the podcast, our regulars as usual, Mills Kelly from Edwired.org. Hey, Mills.
Hey, how's it going?
Happy New Year. Yeah, Happy New Year. And Tom Scheinfeld from FoundHistory.org. Hey, Tom.
Hey, guys.
And, you know, since it's 2009 and we love ribbing Mills, we'll also give out our Twitter names. Right, Mills?
That's right. You guys just go ahead.
Easy to remember, of course. Tom, of course, just like his blog, is at Found History on Twitter. You should go ahead and follow him. If you want Tom live, of course, you can find him there on Twitter in addition to the blog and the podcast. And I'm Dan Cohen on Twitter. So take a look if you haven't. You know, I don't know about you, Tom, but I've noticed that there's a huge movement toward Twitter in the last month or so.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's amazing how many new followers each day are coming through just from, you know, graduate students in humanities programs and communications programs and media programs and new institutions, small museums, libraries, departments, all kinds of stuff. So yeah, it really is amazing. I just told everybody on Twitter that I'm on Skype with at Dan Cohen and Twitter skeptic Mills Kelly recording a new Digital Campus. So
Twitter skeptic. We'll start introducing Mills in that way. Twitter skeptic. Yeah. I mean, I've noticed
okay,
it too.
I can live with it. I'm going to be the last person who's never tweeted.
Right. You will be the last man standing. You know, I've started to get friended or followed, I guess, by some students at George Mason who think it's just the coolest that I'm online on Twitter. I think they're surprised to find.
You've got your own stalkers, isn't that great?
I know. Yeah.
Yeah. It is a little weird, but
yeah. But that was, I think, a sign to me is that undergraduates are moving on to Twitter, whereas Facebook was the kind of public instant messaging system. But now, you know, I've been followed by about 10 undergrads, and I don't know. That seems to say something to me. I think in 2009, we're going to see a lot more mainstreaming of Twitter, with the exception of Mills Kelly.
That's
well,
right.
I think
our
resident, you know,
Twitter skeptic.
While we're on this topic of Twitter, I mean, one thing we saw, you know, this, you know, sort of a This Week in Google story, we did see that Google is going to be releasing its Twitter competitor, Jaiku. It bought a few years ago an early Twitter competitor called Jaiku, a company I think out of Finland. And they're going to be releasing it as part of their Google Apps suite. So you'll be able to build your own sort of internal Twitter microblogging messaging service for your own institution or your own working group or any kind of ad hoc group, I believe. So as part of the Google Apps suite, the Google Apps for your domain suite. So that's kind of an interesting development in that space as well.
Yeah, and I think this is probably where it's going to head is I know a lot of companies that use Yammer, which is a kind of white label Twitter clone, really.
Right.
Again, sort of public instant messaging with ad hoc groups of interest that form. And I think, you know, that's why I was kind of a skeptic of Twitter for about a year. But I'm getting into it now simply because it sort of makes real some communities that cross disciplinary boundaries for me. So it's a great way to connect. You know, I'm not a librarian, but I connect with a lot of librarians who are working in the digital realm through Twitter. It's a great place to crowdsource answers to things that, you know, we have. For instance, a couple of days ago, we launched, thanks to Jeremy Boggs, our creative lead here at CHNM, a new design for the Digital Campus website, which you should go check out at digitalcampus.tv and let us know what you think about it through our feedback email address. But, you know, I was able to tweet that, and then I instantly got 10 responses. Some of them were really helpful technical responses about some things that Jeremy needed to tweak in the HTML, and other responses were just aesthetic commentary. So I'm actually thinking on my next, I'm writing a few articles right now, and my next article that I finish, I might post it on my blog in a kind of draft form and then tweet it and ask people to do a kind of pre-peer review through Twitter, see how that goes. I'm not sure how that'll work out, considering they only have 140 characters to comment, but maybe that's all the criticism I want. Yeah. I guess the other, you know, story on Twitter is, you know, it's really allowed us to see what was going on at some of the professional organizations' annual meetings. So in particular, there seemed to be a really high activity this year at the Modern Language Association meeting in San Francisco. So I don't know, Tom, were you able to follow that online? I mean, there were a bunch of people we follow that were at MLA, and you could kind of get a good sense of what was going on at the meeting without actually being there.
Yeah, there was a lot coming out of MLA, probably more coming, well, definitely more coming out of MLA than AHA, which goes on just the weekend after MLA, I believe. And yeah, there was an awful lot going on. One of our friends and Twitter friends, colleagues up at NYU, Amanda French, has a good post up now at amandafrench.net that basically is a dump from all of her various streams, the channels that she uses to connect to people, Twitter, email, IM, all the others, where she kind of lays out the kinds of conversations that were going on these different channels, and that I think can give people who don't use these messaging systems a good idea of the kind of interactions that take place during a meeting like MLA, these other micro messaging services.
Yeah, that's a great post to take a look at, and you could kind of see the rolling conversation on it. We'll of course link to that from the digitalcampus.tv site. And if you want to follow Amanda French, she's Amanda French on Twitter. Well, a lot of stories over the last 3 weeks since we did our year-end review. You know, since we did claim that mobile was really the number one story, and we think will continue to be the number one story in 2009, I suppose all of us were pretty interested in the big mobile announcements from CES and Macworld, the big kind of trade shows that occurred at the same time that MLA was going on and the American Historical Association meeting was going on. And I guess the big announcement that kind of caught our eye was the launch of Palm's new operating system called WebOS for smartphones, I should say. And particularly they showed a phone from Sprint called the Palm Pre. Not such a great name. But the technology is pretty interesting, I think, for the audience of the Digital Campus podcast, at least as I see it, Mills and Tom, in that, you know, we've talked a lot about developing education, museum, and library applications for the iPhone, I think, in particular. We've obviously been pretty Mac-centric and focused on the iPhone. And more recently, we've talked about maybe what you could do with Android. But I think what caught our eye in terms of the Palm Pre was just the really the ease of developing applications for the platform. It is the first smartphone operating system that we've seen, and feel free to correct us on our blog if this is incorrect, but it really just uses basic web technologies to create really nice looking web applications. So it uses things like HTML and cascading style sheets, CSS, and JavaScript, which is you know, not such a pretty language to look at, but is the basic language that a lot of web logic is created with. And for instance, the Zotero plugin for Firefox that we have here at the Center for History and New Media is created using JavaScript. So it's a good, solid basic web programming language. And really, you don't need much more than that to create really nice looking applications for the Palm Pre. And, you know, my feeling on all this is that we, you know, if we want to advance digital humanities and the activities that we've promoted on the podcast, you need to have more people trying to create applications, trying to do programming. And for that, you need to be using, I think, you know, easier to use languages than, for instance, Objective-C, which is what you need for iPhone development, or Java, or some of these kind of more hardcore languages. Did the two of you take a look at the Palm Pre, and what are your initial thoughts on that as a potential platform for, let's say, a museum that wants to have a tour, or a classroom that might want to do something with an application?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it is, as you say, Dan, I think it's going to be a lot easier to develop applications for that platform. I mean, I think we didn't get that good a look at the Pre. I think there was a lot of buzz about it, but I think I'd have to see a little more before I knew exactly what you could do with it. But it does
bit of speculation here.
Yeah, it does seem like it's going to be. It was very well received, and especially for a product from a company that has not had very many hits in the last. Closing in on a decade, you know, Palm is this is I think its last best chance to get back into this market,
I guess we should mention, you know, Palm was really the originator of this whole category of a kind of smart small device. I mean, I guess we could go back and say Apple started it all with the idea of a personal digital assistant and the ill-fated Newton, which had the world's worst handwriting recognition, and certainly there were other entrants before the Palm came along, but you know, I remember the Palm Pilot was the kind of first little device that wasn't a computer, that a digital device that I kind of carried around with me all the time, that had calendar and note-taking capabilities and these sorts of things.
Yeah, I know. I lived and died for my Palm, in 98, 99, that time frame. I think so I do think it's going to be easier to develop for, and I think that is that kind of lightweight, low barrier device is really what's needed for it to catch on in the digital humanities museum library communities. I think, you know, to be honest, I think that's what the iPhone was shooting for when it first came out. People remember when the iPhone first came out, there was no App Store. There was no way to put additional applications on the iPhone, and when asked about that, Steve Jobs and Apple basically said, well, if you want to build an application for the iPhone, build it in HTML, CSS, JavaScript, Ajax for the Safari mobile web browser. And their idea was that applications that ran through the iPhone were going to be web applications formatted for that small screen browser.
I remember Jobs saying, "It's a phone; it's not a computer."
Right, right, and you know, he was sort of torpedoed by the hacker community, which broke into the phone, started developing applications, and then I think Apple had to kind of hurry up and follow suit and find a way to monetize that, which they did, you know, in very in short order and very well, but. Their idea initially, I think, was the same idea that Palm has, which is let's do it with web technologies rather than doing it with things like Objective-C.
Well, you're right. I mean, I guess we should point out that you can develop, you know, I guess what we call web applications for the iPhone and Android, but just by using the regular web browser. And so especially using CSS, you can reformat any kind of website to be more iPhone-ish. And really, initially, for instance, companies like Facebook were very quick to get on the iPhone even before the App Store, simply because they created, you know, iPhone.facebook.com, which was a version of the Facebook website that was formatted for a 320 by 240 screen and, you know, had some of the feel of an iPhone app even before iPhone apps occurred. So I guess that's still possible, but there is something about people like that idea of a little icon, and there is more things you can do with an actual application than you can do in the web browser. So I guess it makes sense to create a full-blown application development environment.
Yeah, and in terms of classroom technology, I mean, it's going to have, for it to catch on in the classroom environment, it's going to have to be something that's cross-platform, because it's really going to be impossible to expect all students to have the same kind of phone. They're going to have 14 different phones in your class. But the sooner we can have sort of easily developed HTML-based, kind of simple HTML-based or Java-based applications for education, I think the better, because I think students really want to do that. And if you can develop things simply in HTML, then that's a pretty low barrier. Almost any college student today could come up with something interesting or just useful. And so I can imagine, a year or two from now, when things are more cross-platform, that digital humanities courses even are going to say to students, go out in the field and make something.
Well, that's really what I hope to see too. Is this something that is more cross-platform? I mean, I think now the answer when people are asked about what should museums or what should scholars do for mobile, the answer is do it all. Build the application that works on Opera Mini and on Safari Mobile. Build the iPhone application. Build an Android application. And that's not, in the end, for to be realistic, for our kinds of budgets and our kinds of resources, that's not really sustainable. We can't be building six different versions of every project that we create. I just don't see that as a long-term strategy for this. So I really hope, I think, to see something that is maybe does thread this needle, and maybe that is the new web OS. Maybe this is that compromise where it's using the web technologies, but it's a kind of, to build a kind of native application. Maybe that's the direction things will take. I hope that there's some shakeout in this space so that we can kind of standardize and have some cross-platform compatibility. Because right now, I think the lift is just too heavy for cultural institutions.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the big question is whether the pre gets any users, and then also, it seems like with Android being licensed in an open source way, in a very liberal open source way, so pretty much anybody can take Android and stick it on any device they want. They don't have to pay a Google licensing fee or anything like that. People have already hacked Android to work on a netbook, a little lightweight laptop, which is becoming, as we've discussed, it was in our top 10 for 2008, that it's something that students like a lot. So I can see that really spreading quickly as a lot of people put it on many different kinds of devices. If Palm is really stuck with Sprint for a year or two, I'm just not seeing the spread, even though I love the idea of creating what are effectively applications that are just little web widgets, but that float in a phone environment rather than a web, a web screen environment.
Yeah, I love the idea too. I think the other worry about Android though is, I'm big on the bandwagon of Android, and I'm dying for my contract to end, to get rid of my BlackBerry and to get a G1, or hopefully there'll be another Android device out by the time my contract does end. But one of the things that came out of CES was there were no new Android devices announced. I don't think a single one. Which seems a little strange that a year on and 3 or 4 months on from the first release of an Android device and all the hype, that we didn't see manufacturers or carriers announcing demoing prototypes of new Android devices. So, hopefully that's just, we're going to see a wave of them in the next few months. But so far there's that T-Mobile G1 and that's it.
Right. Well, I guess one problem we haven't discussed yet about all these environments is that they run on touchscreens. And Mills, you kind of forwarded an interesting article about Stevie Wonder and touchscreens and how they, we might be moving into this environment and alienating a whole segment of the population. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, this article was actually forwarded to me by one of our postdocs, Rebecca Scales, and she said she's very interested in issues of accessibility, and it's from MSNBC, and it's Stevie Wonder appearing at the Consumer Electronics Show just recently. And he points out that the whole touchscreen technology completely alienates the blind community because it's worthless for them. And it's, I mean, this is really a problem for educators, and I think for public historians, for museum professionals, is this, you know, we've been so focused on ease of use and fun and excitement around touchscreens, and there's this whole segment of the market that just got left behind. And, you know, I think we have a real obligation to think about that as we're going forward. You know, when the three of us said that touchscreen kinds of things are going to be, you know, the next one of the next big things, none of us thought about this.
Yeah, I'm sort of embarrassed to say I didn't think about it at all.
Me too.
You know, and I do think this is an important thing. You know, hopefully we'll see some, there are some developments I think that, may help with accessibility. I mean, things like haptics are starting to, get a lot of attention. This is like where you touch the screen and you actually get some, a little vibration, a little bit of feedback. So if, let's say you're typing on a touchscreen keyboard, when you hit a certain key, it kind of bounces back, so you get a little bit of that physical feedback. Those kinds of developments, hopefully there are ways to make these touchscreen devices more accessible for those communities. And I think, you know, we have colleagues up at the University of Toronto in the Fluid Project who are exploring these kinds of things. So for the cultural heritage and scholarly community. So hopefully we'll be able to push in that direction. But it is something that I think not enough people are thinking about.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, there's in the United States, there's something called Section 508 compliance that federal organizations have to abide by, which allows for full accessibility to all digital media for people who are blind, people who have other kinds of impairments. And, you know, it's, again, something that I can't believe didn't strike me right away. But, you know, at least from the federal perspective, and it's a little unclear how much Section 508 extends to, for instance, the state. So George Mason University is a state institution. Sometimes you get pressure, and I think they do, in fact, try to make their main George Mason website Section 508 compliance, but it's not entirely clear how much that then trickles down to, for instance, the history department. But of course, everyone wants to try to be compliant with an environment that works for you know, the maximum number of people. And so I think this is something that we'll have to keep track of.
We should also note that, like, it's fairly accepted, I think, that 508 does apply to projects funded by federal grants. And so things like if you have an NEH grant, you know, you're supposed to be at least doing your very best to meet those guidelines.
Yeah, I mean, it might be worth a featured story at some point on Section 508. You know, I mean, a lot of it is not that difficult, but some things would be really difficult. And it's particularly true with a touch interface, for instance, a multi-touch. I mean, how do you have some kind of command that is not, you know, that doesn't really have a textual equivalent, like a pan and zoom and flip and flick and all these things that the iPhone added a year ago or 2 years ago now. Those are really difficult to create equivalents for instance, an audio web browser for blind people. So tricky. You know, it struck me that one new tech item that was in our top 10 from 2008 that does have a way to comply with this is these ebook readers like the Kindle, which in most cases do create audio equivalents and have headphone jacks in them. So if you have a book that's on the Kindle or let's say the Sony Reader, you can plug a headphone in and listen to that book in addition to viewing it. I just mentioned that by way of another story that kind of caught our eye over the last few weeks was a story in Inside Higher Ed about Northwest Missouri State University, which is experimenting with going ebook only, or at least close to it. Very soon, they in fact did a trial with about 500 students in 10 different courses where they bought a bunch of Sony ebook readers, the PRS 505, which if you've seen is a kind of nicer looking competitor to the Kindle. And they had kind of a mixed bag on this. I mean, it's something we've talked about. I mean, textbooks could be a really good fit for ebook readers, and they cost a lot. And Northwest Missouri State is projecting they could save 50% on their textbook costs. In fact, this little trial, it was only $6 per credit hour to rent a textbook on a Sony ebook reader. We've thought a lot about this. Is this maybe the year where we'll see more of these trials? You know, there was a lot of resistance too, I think, among professors and some of the students. What do you think about this model of maybe renting out the devices and the content, but maybe not giving the students the textbook when they're done with it? And that's one of the gripes about this, is you just don't have the textbook when you're done.
I mean, at least I remember when I was an undergraduate, you know, for most of the textbooks, most of those I ended up selling back anyway. It's not like I have a ton of undergraduate textbooks sitting around on my shelves. So, you know, I think that might not be as big a worry as some may think.
I think it's less of a worry in the humanities and social sciences. I think it's probably more of a worry in the sciences and the health sciences, where students actually do hang on to that. I mean, you know, in the health sciences, anatomy and physiology textbooks, I think, hang around for a while. So you can remember it's two kidneys and one liver and things like that. But, you know,
I would hope my doctor would remember that without an ebook reader.
Yes. I figure that's the absolute baseline of an anatomical knowledge for, you know, good health. But and everything everything after that is just details. But I think it is a serious issue that, you know, in it, whether it's in, you know, physics or organic chemistry or something, I think students do hang on to some of those textbooks, at least through the end of their undergraduate experience. And so that there's a question there. If they can work this out so that these ebook readers are more than just a convenient way of providing books, where they have some kind of connectivity to the web, then I think that there's a real possibility there. But the thing that bothered me about this story is it strikes me as yet another example of kind of top-down imposition of technology on the educational process, and with this idea that somehow technology is going to be the solution to a problem which may or may not exist in an individual classroom. And so, I mean, okay, there's a larger problem there, which is the cost of textbooks. And this will certainly address that issue for students. And at the moment, given our current economic environment, anything that saves people money will probably be popular. But to assume that just giving everybody an ebook reader is somehow a panacea for other kinds of educational issues, I think is just plain wrong. And so I'd be really interested to read more about faculty responses to this. And this is not, for me, an issue of, you know, I'm a professor, I have rights, I get to control what goes on in my classroom. But instead, it's more of an issue of institutions deciding kind of centrally which technology implementations ought to be used by everybody. So, you know, on our own campus, the classic example of that is that they've pulled the VHS readers out of almost every classroom on campus, because that's old technology. Nobody uses that anymore, except for the faculty members who are using the 3,000 or 4,000 VHS tapes in the library. So all of a sudden, you know, you have to go through this long process of getting a VHS converted to a DVD, and it's, you know, it's a huge hassle. But that's because we decided centrally that that's what we needed to do. So I worry about these kinds of centralized decisions about technology implementation to solve an educational problem that may or may not exist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like Northwest Missouri might have heard you already, Mills. It looks like this spring they've fallen back on putting the textbooks on the students' existing laptop computers, so they can kind of bring whatever laptop or netbook they want, and they've got a kind of version of this to go on the laptops as well. You know, from the student side, it seems like one big issue was just readability and you know, follow-up study of these 500 students. 75% of them said they prefer a printed textbook to a digital one. 33% said they felt comfortable reading on a computer screen. 22% were uncomfortable, and 45% were in the middle. And then they talk about how they felt like there was a difference between, for instance, reading a Facebook profile, sort of grazing on online content, and reading a textbook, that these were two very different things.
Well, I'm glad to hear that they gave them the laptop option, if only because then it's a much bigger screen probably. But the more important thing, I think, is the connectivity to the web and other kinds of resources. But I'm really interested to hear that they were still fans of the physical book. That's a very interesting statistic.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe these things will just change incredibly slowly, and you know, the bleeding edge that we're on is not what most people like. Well, speaking of the dangers of being on the bleeding edge, it looks like Google has started killing off or changing a lot of the services that they provide that students might rely on, and researchers in general in our world of academia and libraries and museums. I guess the big one that was killed this week that we've noticed is Google Notebook, which is rather shocking. I mean, it looked like they had put a lot of resources into it and promoted it quite a bit. For those who hadn't used this was a web service whereby you could basically clip a web page as you're surfing around and type some notes about it and save it to a central location in your Google account and share it with other people. I thought it had quite a few users. And when I on Twitter, I tweeted about this yesterday, a lot of people were really surprised. Tom, you've increasingly relied on the Google mothership for your services. Yeah. Does this give you pause at all that they could pull the rug out from underneath you?
Yeah, more than a little pause, actually. You know, this weekend I was spent most of the weekend working on various proposals and things. And I used Backpack from 37 Signals to kind of do personal task management, organize my life. And I was getting fairly fed up with it because it just had gotten gotten really bloated, and it wasn't doing what I wanted it to do. And so I was sort of thinking, I kind of went to Google Notebook and was thinking, well, maybe I could use this Google Notebook thing for some of this instead of Backpack. Ultimately, I decided against it, and now I'm very glad that I didn't spend a half a day moving all my Backpack stuff over to Google Notebook. But it does give me pause. I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, 37 Signals isn't going to go under tomorrow and take my Backpack with it either. This is one of the worries about relying on a commercial service for especially these kind of Web 2.0 services for your scholarly work. You know, I think that's just a very narrow personal example of how it can be troublesome that, you know, Google can just kill off an app if it feels like it without really any apology or any notice. But I think this problem extends to the institutional context as well, where, you know, if a museum decides to move its email system, let's say, over to Google Apps and you know, ditch its Microsoft Office license and move to Google Apps. To save all of the documents and things, you know, if Google decides, you know, this isn't the direction for us. Really, our main core business is search and advertising, and all this application stuff is you know, kind of peripheral. Let's be done with it. You know, there's not much you can do. I think we saw a little bit of this too with the Flickr Commons over the last couple of weeks, where George Oates, the head of Flickr Commons, Flickr's owned by Yahoo. Yahoo's made a lot of job cuts, and one of the job cuts was George Oates, the head of Flickr Commons. And now the sort of future of Flickr Commons is a little bit in doubt. I think the communities are large enough, and the institutional partners are strong enough and committed enough that Flickr Commons will last. But it does raise this issue of, you know, cultural heritage institutions, educational institutions, relying on commercial web services for a lot of their core work. You know, there's a worry about the permanence of that, and spending a lot of resources and putting a lot of resources into these services that could disappear at any time. So it is worrying.
Go ahead, Mills.
I was going to say, for Tom, for the, you know, your Backpack stuff, can I suggest an application called Zotero? Maybe you've heard of it.
That's what I said to people on Google Notebook. We'll pick up, because you see a lot of people in blog posts and in their on Twitter saying, should I choose between Google Notebook and Zotero? Well, now that just became very easy for you. The decision tree has been narrowed down for you on that. But beyond, of course, plugging our own software, you know, I think the big problem with these services that get shut down is when, at least for academics, is, you know, your research is so critical and, you know, it's your life. And the problem with Google Notebook, as I saw it, is it's a little bit different than Gmail. Like, if Gmail were to shut down, which, God forbid, Mills, you'd be in big trouble. Or, excuse me, Tom, you'd be in big trouble. But, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. But at least email is a kind of common format. You could, in fact, download all of your Gmail. It would take you a long time to your personal computer and change programs and use something else.
Yes,
but
yeah.
Something that's idiosyncratic like Google Notebook, there really isn't an export for. And, you know, I guess this has been our griping on this podcast about virtual worlds as well. In fact, we discussed this on the year-end roundup a few weeks ago for 2008. You know, when Google killed Lively off, which was their virtual world, they said, well, no real way for you to export what you've done, but we'll give you 48 hours to go in and take photographs of it you know, say, wave goodbye to your avatars before we shut it down completely. And I'm not really seeing with Google Notebook any way to export it into any format that you could, for instance, import into Zotero or any other program. So for those things, that's really highly problematic. Okay, well, I guess we'll gripe more about this in 2009. So a couple of other quick news items that caught our eye before we move on to picks for the week. One story really was interesting. I don't think we've discussed yet on the podcast. This really started a couple of months ago, but we haven't had a chance to kind of think about it, is RNA Biology, which is a journal, as you might imagine, about RNA, surprisingly, the well-named RNA Biology, instituted a policy whereby authors, scientists, biologists who are submitting articles for to this journal have to actually, in addition to sending the article in for peer review, put a page up on Wikipedia about the article. So using Wikipedia as a kind of public peer review, you know, longtime listeners to the podcast know that our very first podcast, episode one in early 2007, was about Wikipedia and its uses and abuses. Mills, is this a use or abuse, or isn't this just a very odd use of Wikipedia?
Well, first of all, I have to offer a brief disclaimer here. Now that I've been permanently or temporarily banned from Wikipedia.
Oh, no, for pirates?
Yeah, because of, you know, other things involving piracy. But pirates, piracy, not like intellectual property piracy.
Pirates like with so, peg leg. We should explain, since I think we only hinted at this on the last podcast, that Mills and his class were behind an online hoax about the last American pirate named Edward Owens. Do you want to just briefly explain that?
It's actually probably easier just to go to my blog and read all the stuff okay. going on there. Under the post, you were warned. But so, you know, when my Wikipedia privileges are restored someday, then maybe I can go and look at this in more detail. But I do think it's a really good use of Wikipedia. And I think it speaks to what we talked about in the year-end podcast about how Wikipedia is really entering the mainstream. And it's, you know, our first podcast was actually Wikipedia Friend or Foe. I think we can probably begin to move the foe off of that appellation, because you know, it's increasing. This is a further example of the kind of mainstreaming of Wikipedia.
But what I don't get is, why is there a new page for each article? I can understand, for
that
instance,
doesn't make any sense.
Adding a link into a preprint version, let's say under the RNA article. I just don't get why you'd have an article.
Right, and the article is going to what? Be edited? So like gradually over time, the abstract on Wikipedia is going to diverge from what's printed in the journal. It's a very strange model. I mean, I could understand that if the journal article in question were introducing, let's say, a new topic. Some new concept or some new finding that didn't already have a page on Wikipedia, that the author would be required to add a page on that concept or that finding or that protein or whatever it is.
Right, that makes a lot of sense.
To Wikipedia and start a kind of a public discussion about it on Wikipedia. But to put the text, some text from the article itself, or some abstract of the article itself on Wikipedia, and then have a page for each article, seems a little strange.
It seems a lot. I mean, does this mean that I now get to put up an abstract of my book?
Right. That's the other thing. Is how is the Wikipedia community like responding to that? I think this is something
we should
probably
talk about. It doesn't scale at all. I mean, actually, that's kind of an interesting idea. I mean, you could. I mean, but what would happen if, for instance, the Journal of American History asked all authors, even of articles that don't get published, right? Because that's what RNA biology is doing here, to post something on Wikipedia. It doesn't seem like this scales very well, although there is something that I kind of like about the idea. I mean, it's not, I think they're on to something here, but maybe this isn't the correct venue on the main Wikipedia site. I mean, maybe this is something where you get an installation of MediaWiki, which is the open source wiki software that Wikipedia runs on, and you use that as your location for posting. Maybe there's some way to do that. Well, I guess our final story is just a editor's note of coming back to a story that we covered on a earlier podcast. I think it was Digital Campus 33, where we mentioned the sort of European competitor to Google's online library. It's called Europeana, and it's a massive digital library with over 2 million objects. It launched, I think, in November and immediately crashed the same day because it got so many hits, I think over 10 million hits. It's back online. We'll link to it from the digitalcampus.tv site. They have a kind of, again, it's a test installation, so be kind to it. Luckily, we don't have that many listeners that we could crash the site, although we'd love to have more listeners, and we hope you do tell everyone about the podcast this year in 2009. But it is back online. It's looking pretty good. I guess what it's doing now is something that we kind of mentioned on that earlier podcast, at least in my testing of it, is that it links out to the specific library that hosts the object. So it kind of decreases the burden on the centralized Europeana site, makes it more of a federated search, as far as I can tell. And again, it's clear they have a lot of work left to do. Have either of you checked out the new version of this?
I have not had a chance to check it out yet.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it to our audience to check it out. It's at europeana.eu/portal. And again, we'll link to that from the blog, because it takes you now to a special page that says, you know, basically, please be gentle in several different languages as they ramp up. I still think they're doing the technology back end sorts of things, but it'll be interesting to see how that goes and again, whether they get more diverse content since upon launch. And indeed, as far as I can tell, currently much of the content, about half, is from French sources. So even when I looked up some of the materials that I'm interested in the Victorian era, I was assuming I would get the Bodleian or the British Library, and I actually pulled up some documents that were in the Bibliothèque Nationale that were in English. So I think it's pretty clear that the French have been a little bit more aggressive about using the portal. Again, that's Europeana. We'll link to it from digitalcampus.tv. As we've done for the past couple of years on the podcast, we like to end with our picks of the week. These are links, pieces of software, things we've read online or off that might interest our audience. Mills, maybe we could start with you this week.
Okay, well, this falls into the category a little bit of old news, but it's from TechCrunch back in October, and it's a story about various services like ReFrameIt and Flex and others that are trying to kind of recycle the idea of
tagging the web the way that older services like Third Voice and uTalk and others back in the late 90s tried. And this is something I was always really interested in. I've talked about a lot on my blog and other places because I found it incredibly useful back in the 90s. And so somebody sent me the link to this story, and I tried all of these services, and I guess I'm just going to have to say that this is really over. Because none of them works as well as Delicious or just simply blogging about something. And if I use Twitter, I would probably say that too. So I think this is sort of a story about something, a web app that's just never going to work, because it's, if you look at this link that we'll put into the blog, you can take a look at these services, and I've tried them all, and none of them work as well as existing other kinds of Web 2.0 applications. So it's really a story about how Web 2.0 has, I think, killed off an idea that in Web 1.0 was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a lot of services that pursued that idea. Okay, great. We'll link to that article from digitalcampus.tv. Tom, what do you have for us this week?
I've got a conference link, a call for papers for the American Association for History and Computing, whose annual meeting is going to be this April at George Mason, hosted by president of the AAHC, our own Jeremy Boggs at cleoweb.org. It's April 3rd to 5th. The URL for the American Association for History and Computing is theaahc.org. We'll post that in the show notes. And we encourage, it looks like it's going to be a great conference on frontiers in digital history. Really a chance to blue sky some new ideas in digital history. And we encourage people to sign up and put in a proposal.
Yeah, that sounds terrific. And I should mention, I might show off my Wii balance board / history surfing idea that I've been talking about. I got my Wii balance board connected to Google Earth with some historical overlays on it, and you can literally surf through ancient Rome using it. Will be fun for the kiddies, and hopefully have pedagogical uses as well. Well, just staying on the mobile theme for a second, you know, again, we here on the podcast, we try to look around for applications, things that kind of might, you know, spur the imagination in our audience. Think about new ways that you might want to do something and with a cell phone in 2009. And I think a really good example that I saw on Lifehacker is a new application called Hear Planet. That's H-E-A-R, Planet, all one word. And what it is, it's a... it's basically an iPhone or iTouch application that uses the iPhone's location services. So that's, if you program for the iPhone, there's a sort of call that you can make to the phone to say, hey, where am I? And then you can use that information in the application. Well, Hear Planet uses those location services to determine where you are. And then once it figures that out, it goes to Wikipedia and downloads the introductory text for the area you're in. So the example they have on their website is you're standing on the Golden Gate Bridge. The iPhone figures that out, and it pops up the text from Wikipedia about the Golden Gate Bridge, and it then converts that into audio, which is really nice. So you get like a one-minute walking tour for free wherever you are. Pretty neat. Try it out. See what you think. It doesn't work in all locations. Didn't work for me in Maryland, but I assume if you're in a pretty specific location where, of course, my iPhone is not the GPS iPhone, so maybe you need more specific location services to have this work really well. But again, something just to kind of get the gears moving about what you might want to do with mobile in 2009. I think this might be a nice application to look at if you're, let's say, running a Civil War battlefield and you want to think about the way in which you might use a cell phone, which is something that one of my students in Clio Wired in last fall did. And this is a pretty similar implementation to what she thought of that their organization might want to use in the field. Again, that's Hear Planet, and we'll link to it from our blog at digitalcampus.tv. Well, Mills and Tom, looking forward to another year, another good year of podcasting with the two of you. And we'll see everyone back in 2 weeks for another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.